Blackstone Audio presents The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick. To my wife, Tessa, and my son, Christopher, with great and awful love. Chapter 1. For a week, Mr. R. Chilton had been anxiously watching the mail, but the valuable shipment from the Rocky Mountain States had not arrived. As he opened up his store on Friday morning and saw only letters on the floor by the mail slot, he thought, "I'm going to have an angry customer." Pouring himself a cup of instant tea from the 5-cent wall dispenser, he got a broom and began to sweep. Soon he had the front of American Artistic Handicrafts Incorporated ready for the day, all spick and span with a cash register full of change, a fresh vase of marigolds, and the radio playing background music. Outdoors along the sidewalk, businessmen hurried toward their offices along Montgomery Street. Far off, a cable car passed. Chilton halted to watch it with pleasure. Women in their long, colorful silk dresses. He watched them, too. Then the phone rang. He turned to answer it. "Yes," a familiar voice said to his answer. Chilton's heart sank. "This is Mr. Tagomi. Did my Civil War recruiting poster arrive yet, sir? Please recall, you promised it sometime last week." The fussy, brisk voice, barely polite, barely keeping the code. "Did I not give you a deposit, sir, Mr. Chilton, with that stipulation? This is to be a gift, you see. I explained that. A client."
"Extensive inquiries," Chilton began, "which I've had made at my own expense, Mr. Tagomi, sir, regarding the promised parcel, which you realize originates outside of this region, and is therefore—"
But Tagomi broke in.
"Then it has not arrived?"
"No, Mr. Tagomi, sir."
An icy pause.
"I can wait no further more," Tagomi said.
"No, sir."
Chilton gazed morosely through the store window at the warm, bright day and the San Francisco office buildings.
"A substitute, then. Your recommendation, Mr. Chilton?"
Tagomi deliberately mispronounced the name, insult within the code that made Chilton's ears burn. Place pulled. The dreadful mortification of their situation. Robert Chilton's aspirations and fears and torments rose up and exposed themselves, swamped him, stopping his tongue. He stammered, his hand sticky on the phone. The air of his store smelled of the marigolds. The music played on, but he felt as if he were falling into some distant sea.
"Well," he managed to mutter, "butter churn? Ice cream maker circa 1900?
His mind refused to think. Just when you forgot about it, just when you fool yourself. He was 38 years old, and he could remember the pre-war days, the other times. Franklin D. Roosevelt and the World's Fair, the former, better world.
"Could I bring various desirable items out to your business location?"
he mumbled. An appointment was made for 2 o'clock. Have to shut store, he knew as he hung up the phone. No choice. Have to keep goodwill of such customers. Business depends on them. Standing shakily, he became aware that someone, a couple, had entered the store. Young man and girl, both handsome, well-dressed, ideal. He calmed himself and moved professionally, easily, in their direction, smiling. They were bending to scrutinize a counter display, had picked up a lovely ashtray. Married, he guessed. Live out in City of the Winding Mists, the new exclusive apartments on Skyline overlooking Belmont.
"Hello,"
he said, and felt better. They smiled at him without any superiority, only kindness. His displays, which really were the best of their kind on the coast, had awed them a little. He saw that and was grateful. They understood.
"Really excellent pieces, sir,"
the young man said. Chilton bowed spontaneously. Their eyes, warm not only with human bond, but with the shared enjoyment of the art objects he sold, their mutual tastes and satisfactions, remained fixed on him. They were thanking him for having things like these for them to see, pick up and examine, handle perhaps without even buying. Yes, he thought, they know what sort of store they are in. This is not tourist trash, not redwood plaques reading Muir Woods, Marin County, PSA, or funny signs or girly rings or postcards or views of the bridge. The girl's eyes especially, large, dark. How easily, Chilton thought, I could fall in love with a girl like this. How tragic my life then, as if it weren't bad enough already. The stylish black hair, lacquered nails, pierced ears for the long, dangling brass handmade earrings.
"Your earrings," he murmured. "Purchased here, perhaps?"
"No," she said. "At home." Children nodded. No contemporary American art. Only the past could be represented here in a store such as his.
"You are here for long?"
he asked.
"To our San Francisco?"
"I'm stationed here indefinitely," the man said, "with standard of living for unfortunate areas planning commission of inquiry." Pride showed on his face. Not the military. Not one of the gum-chewing, boorish draftees with their greedy peasant faces wandering up Market Street, gaping at the bawdy shows, the sex movies, the shooting galleries, the cheap nightclubs with photos of middle-aged blondes holding their nipples between their wrinkled fingers and leering. The honky-tonk jazz slums that made up most of the flat part of San Francisco, rickety tin and board shacks that had sprung up from the ruins even before the last bomb fell. No, this man was of the elite. Cultured, educated, even more so than Mr. Tagomi, who was, after all, a high official with a ranking trade mission on the Pacific coast. Tagomi was an old man. His attitudes had formed in the War Cabinet days.
"Had you wished American traditional ethnic art objects as a gift?" Sheldon asked. "Or to decorate, perhaps, a new apartment for your stay here?"
"If the latter..." His heart picked up.
"An accurate guess," the girl said. "We are starting to decorate. A bit undecided. Do you think you could inform us?"
"I could arrange to arrive at your apartment, yes," Sheldon said. "Bringing several hand cases, I can suggest in context at your leisure. This, of course, is our specialty."
He dropped his eyes so as to conceal his hope. There might be thousands of dollars involved.
"I am getting in a New England table, maple, all wood-pegged, no nails, immense beauty and worth, and a mirror from the time of the 1812 war, and also the Aboriginal art, a group of vegetable-dyed goat-hair rugs."
"I myself," the man said, "prefer the art of the cities."
"Yes," Sheldon said eagerly. "Listen, sir. I have a mural from WPA post office period, original, done on board, four sections, depicting Horace Greeley. Priceless collector's item."
"Ah," the man said, his dark eyes flashing.
"And a Victrola cabinet of 1920, made into a liquor cabinet."
"Ah.
And, sir, listen, framed signed picture of Jean Harlow."
The man goggled at him.
"Shall we make arrangements?"
Sheldon said, seizing this correct psychological instant. From his inner coat pocket he brought his pen, notebook.
"I shall take your name and address, sir and lady."
Afterward, as the couple strolled from his store, Sheldon stood, hands behind his back, watching the street. Joy. If all business days were like this. But it was more than business, the success of his store. It was a chance to meet a young Japanese couple socially, on a basis of acceptance of him as a man, rather than him as a Yank, or, at best, a tradesman who sold art objects. Yes, these new young people of the rising generation, who did not remember the days before the war, or even the war itself, they were the hope of the world. Place difference did not have the significance for them. It will end, Sheldon thought. Someday, the very idea of place, not governed and governing, but people. And yet he trembled with fear, imagining himself knocking at their door. He examined his notes. The kasuras. Being admitted, no doubt offered tea. Would he do the right thing? Know the proper act and utterance at each moment? Or would he disgrace himself like an animal by some dismal faux pas? The girl's name was Betty. Such understanding in her face, he thought. The gentle, sympathetic eyes. Surely, even in the short time in the store, she had glimpsed his hopes and defeats. His hopes. He felt suddenly dizzy. What aspirations bordering on the insane, if not the suicidal, did he have? But it was known, relations between Japanese and Yanks, although generally it was between a Japanese man and a Yank woman. This. He quailed at the idea. And she was married. He whipped his mind away from the pageant of his involuntary thoughts and began busily opening the morning's mail. His hands, he discovered, were still shaking. And then he recalled his 2 o'clock appointment with Mr. Tagomi. At that, his hands ceased shaking and his nervousness became determination. "I've got to come up with something acceptable," he said to himself, Where? How? What? A phone call. Sources. Business ability. Scrape up a fully restored 1929 Ford, including fabric top. Black. Grand Slam to keep patronage forever. Crated original mint tri-motor airmail plane discovered in barn in Alabama, etc. Produce mummified head of Mr. B. Bill, including flowing white hair. Sensational American artifact. Make my reputation in top connoisseur circles throughout Pacific, not excluding home islands. To inspire himself, he lit up a marijuana cigarette. Excellent Landa Smiles brand. In his room on Hayes Street, Frank Frink lay in bed wondering how to get up. Sun glared past the blind onto the heap of clothes that had fallen to the floor. His glasses, too. Would he step on them? Try to get to bathroom by other route, he thought. Crawl or roll. His head ached, but he did not feel sad. Never look back, he decided. Time? The clock on the dresser. 11:30. Good grief. But still he lay. I'm fired, he thought. Yesterday he had done wrong at the factory. Spouted the wrong kind of talk to Mr. Wyndham Matson, who had a dished-in face with Socrates-type nose, diamond ring, gold fly-zipper. In other words, a power. A throne. Frink's thoughts wandered groggily. Yes, he thought, and now they'll blacklist me. My skill is no use. I have no trade. 15 years' experience. Gone. And now he would have to appear at the Laborers' Justification Commission for a revision of his work category. Since he had never been able to make out Wyndham Matson's relationship to the Pinocks, the puppet white government at Sacramento, he could not fathom his ex-employer's power to sway the real authorities, the Japanese. The LJC was Pinock-run. He would be facing 4 or 5 middle-aged, plump white faces on the order of Wyndham Matson's. If he failed to get justification there, he would make his way to one of the import-export trade missions which operated out of Tokyo, and which had offices throughout California, Oregon, Washington, and the parts of Nevada included in the Pacific States of America. But if he failed successfully to plead there... Plans roamed his mind as he lay in bed, gazing up at the ancient light fixture in the ceiling. He could, for instance, slip across into the Rocky Mountain states, but it was loosely banded to the PSA and might extradite him. What about the South? His body recoiled. Ugh, not that. As a white man, he would have plenty of place, in fact, more than he had here in the PSA. But he did not want that kind of place. And worse, the South had a cat's cradle of ties, economic, ideological, and God knew what, with the Reich. And Frank Frink was a Jew. His original name was Frank Fink. He had been born on the East Coast in New York, and in 1941 he had been drafted into the Army of the United States of America, right after the collapse of Russia. After the Japs had taken Hawaii, he had been sent to the West Coast. When the war ended, there he was on the Japanese side of the settlement line. And here he was today, 15 years later. In 1947, on Capitulation Day, he had more or less gone berserk. Hating the Japs as he did, he had vowed revenge. He had buried his service weapons 10 feet underground, in a basement, well wrapped and oiled, for the day he and his buddies arose. However, time was the great healer, a fact he had not taken into account. When he thought of the idea now, the great bloodbath, the purging of the Pinocks and their masters, he felt as if he were reviewing one of those stained yearbooks from his high school days, coming upon an account of his boyhood aspirations. Frank Goldfish Fink is going to be a paleontologist and vows to marry Norma Prout. Norma Prout was the class Schönes Mädchen, and he really had vowed to marry her. That was all so goddamn long ago, like listening to Fred Allen or seeing a W.C. Fields movie. Since 1947, he had probably seen or talked to 600,000 Japanese, and the desire to do violence to any or all of them had simply never materialized after the first few months. It just was not relevant anymore. But wait, there was one, a Mr. Omuro, who had bought control of a great area of rental property in downtown San Francisco, and who for a time had been Frank's landlord. There was a bad apple, he thought. A shark who had never made repairs, had partitioned rooms smaller and smaller, raised rents. Omuro had gouged the poor, especially the nearly destitute jobless ex-servicemen during the Depression years of the early 50s. However, it had been one of the Japanese trade missions which had cut off Omuro's head for his profiteering. And nowadays, such a violation of the harsh, rigid, but just Japanese civil law was unheard of. It was a credit to the incorruptibility of the Jap occupation officials, especially those who had come in after the war cabinet had fallen. Recalling the rugged, stoic honesty of the trade missions, Frink felt reassured. Even Wyndham Matson would be waved off like a noisy fly, WM Corporation owner or not. At least, so he hoped. I guess I really have faith in this co-prosperity Pacific Alliance stuff, he said to himself. Strange. Looking back to the early days, it had seemed such an obvious fake then. Empty propaganda. But now... He rose from the bed and unsteadily made his way to the bathroom. While he washed and shaved, he listened to the midday news on the radio.
Let us not deride this effort,
the radio was saying as he momentarily shut off the hot water.
No, we won't, Frink thought bitterly.
He knew which particular effort the radio had in mind. Yet there was, after all, something humorous about it. The picture of stolid, grumpy Germans walking around on Mars, on the red sand where no humans had ever stepped before. Lathering his jowls, Frink began a chanting satire to himself.
Gott, Herr Kreisleiter, ist dies belegt der Ort, wo man das Konzentrationslager bilden kann? Das Wetter ist so schön, heiß, aber doch schön.
The radio said,
Co-prosperity civilization must pause and consider whether in our quest to provide a balanced equity of mutual duties and responsibilities, coupled with remunerations...
Typical jargon from the ruling hierarchy, Frink noted.
We have not failed to perceive the future arena in which the affairs of man will be acted out, be they Nordic, Japanese, Negroid.
On and on it went. As he dressed, he mulled with pleasure his satire. The weather is schön, so schön, but there is nothing to breathe. However, it was a fact. The Pacific had done nothing toward colonization of the planets. It was involved, bogged down, rather, in South America. While the Germans were busy bustling enormous robot construction systems across space, the Japs were still burning off the jungles in the interior of Brazil, erecting 8-floor clay apartment houses for ex-headhunters. By the time the Japs got their first spaceship off the ground, the Germans would have the entire solar system sewed up tight. Back in the quaint old history book days, the Germans had missed out while the rest of Europe put the final touches on their colonial empires. However, Frink reflected, they were not going to be last this time. They had learned. And then he thought about Africa and the Nazi experiment there, and his blood stopped in his veins, hesitated, at last went on. That huge empty ruin. The radio said,
We must consider with pride, however, our emphasis on the fundamental physical needs of peoples of all place, their sub-spiritual aspirations, which must be...
Frink shut the radio off. Then, calmer, he turned it back on. Christ on the crapper, he thought. Africa. For the ghosts of dead tribes. Wiped out to make a land of... what? Who knew? Maybe even the master architects in Berlin did not know. Bunch of automatons building and toiling away. Building. Grinding down. Ogres out of a paleontology exhibit, at their task of making a cup from an enemy's skull... The whole family industriously scooping out the contents, the raw brains, first to eat, then useful utensils of men's leg bones. Thrifty, to think not only of eating the people you did not like, but eating them out of their own skull. The first technicians. Prehistoric man in a sterile white lab coat in some Berlin university lab, experimenting with uses to which other people's skull, skin, ears, fat could be put to.
Ja, Herr Doktor.
A new use for the big toe. See, one can adapt the joint for a quick-acting cigarette lighter mechanism. Now, if only Herr Krupp can produce it in quantity. It horrified him, this thought, the ancient, gigantic, cannibal near-man flourishing now, ruling the world once more. We spent 1,000,000 years escaping him, Frink thought, and now he's back. And not merely as the adversary, but as the master.
We can deplore, the radio, the voice of the little yellow bellies from Tokyo, was saying.
God, Frink thought, and we called them monkeys, these civilized, bandy-legged shrimps, who would no more set up gas ovens than they would melt their wives into sealing wax.
And we have deplored, often in the past, the dreadful waste of humans in this fanatical striving which sets the broader mass of men wholly outside the legal community.
They, the Japs, were so strong on law.
To quote a Western saint familiar to all, What profit a man if he gain the whole world, but in this enterprise lose his soul?
The radio paused. Frink, tying his tie, also paused. It was the morning ablution. I have to make my pact with them here, he realized. Blacklisted or not, it'd be death for me if I left Japanese-controlled land and showed up in the South or in Europe, anywhere in the Reich. I'll have to come to terms with old Wyndham Matson. Seated on his bed, a cup of lukewarm tea beside him, Frink got down his copy of the I Ching. From their leather tube, he took the 49 euro stocks. He considered until he had his thoughts properly controlled and his questions worked out. Aloud, he said, How should I approach Wyndham Matson in order to come to decent terms with him? He wrote the question down on the tablet, then began whipping the euro stocks from hand to hand until he had the first line, the beginning, an 8, half the 64 hexagrams eliminated already. He divided the stocks and obtained the second line. Soon, being so expert, he had all 6 lines. The hexagram lay before him, and he did not need to identify it by the chart. He could recognize it as hexagram 15. Qian, modesty. Ah, the low will be raised up, the high brought down, powerful families humbled. He did not have to refer to the text, he knew it by heart. A good omen. The oracle was giving him favorable counsel. And yet he was a bit disappointed. There was something fatuous about hexagram 15. Too goody-goody. Naturally he should be modest. Perhaps there was an idea in it, however. After all, he had no power over old W.M. He could not compel him to take him back. All he could do was adopt the point of view of hexagram 15. This was that sort of moment when one had to petition, to hope, to await with faith. Heaven in its time would raise him up to his old job, or perhaps even to something better. He had no lines to read, no 9s or 6s. It was static. So he was through. It did not move into a second hexagram. A new question, then. Setting himself, he said aloud, Will I ever see Juliana again? That was his wife, or rather his ex-wife. Juliana had divorced him a year ago, and he had not seen her in months. In fact, he did not even know where she lived. Evidently, she had left San Francisco, perhaps even the PSA. Either their mutual friends had not heard from her, or they were not telling him. Busily he maneuvered the yarrow stalks, his eyes fixed on the tallies. How many times he had asked about Juliana, one question or another. Here came the hexagram, brought forth by the passive chance workings of the vegetable stalks. Random, and yet rooted in the moment in which he lived, in which his life was bound up with all other lives and particles in the universe. The necessary hexagram picturing in its pattern of broken and unbroken lines the situation. He, Juliana, the factory on Gough Street, the trade missions that ruled, the exploration of the planets, the billion chemical heaps in Africa that were now not even corpses, the aspirations of the thousands around him in the shanty warrens of San Francisco, the mad creatures in Berlin with their calm faces and manic plans, all connected in this moment of casting the yarrow stalks to select the exact wisdom appropriate in a book begun in the 30th century B.C., a book created by the sages of China over a period of 5,000 years, winnowed, perfected, that superb cosmology and science, codified before Europe had even learned to do long division. The hexagram. His heart dropped. 44. Coup. Coming to meet. Its sobering judgment. The maiden is powerful. One should not marry such a maiden. Again he had gotten it in connection with Juliana. Ay vey, he thought, settling back. So she was wrong for me. I know that. I didn't ask that. Why does the oracle have to remind me? A bad fate for me, to have met her and been in love, be in love with her. Juliana, the best-looking woman he had ever married. Soot-black eyebrows and hair, trace amounts of Spanish blood distributed as pure color even to her lips. Her rubbery, soundless walk. She had worn saddle shoes left over from high school. In fact, all her clothes had a dilapidated quality and the definite suggestion of being old and often washed. He and she had been so broke so long that despite her looks, she had to wear a cotton sweater, cloth-zippered jacket, brown tweed skirt, and bobby socks. And she hated him and it because it made her look, she had said, like a woman who played tennis, or, even worse, collected mushrooms in the woods. But above and beyond everything else, He had originally been drawn by her screwball expression. For no reason, Juliana greeted strangers with a portentous, nudnik, Mona Lisa smile that hung them up between responses, whether to say hello or not. And she was so attractive that more often than not they did say hello, whereupon Juliana glided by. At first he had thought it was just plain bad eyesight, but finally he had decided that it revealed a deep-dyed, otherwise concealed stupidity at her core. And so, finally, her borderline flicker of greeting to strangers had annoyed him, as had her plant-like, silent, I'm-on-a-mysterious-errand way of coming and going. But even then, toward the end, when they had been fighting so much, he still never saw her as anything but a direct, literal invention of God's, dropped into his life for reasons he would never know. And on that account, a sort of religious intuition of faith about her, he could not get over having lost her. She seemed so close right now, as if he still had her. That spirit, still busy in his life, padding through his room in search of whatever it was Juliana sought, and in his mind, whenever he took up the volumes of the Oracle. Seated on his bed, surrounded by lonely disorder, preparing to go out and begin his day, Frank Frink wondered who else in the vast, complicated city of San Francisco was at this same moment consulting the Oracle. And were they all getting as gloomy advice as he? Was the tenor of the moment as adverse for them as it was for him? Chapter 2 Mr. Nobusuke Tagomi sat consulting the divine fifth book of Confucian wisdom, the Taoist oracle called for centuries the I Ching, or Book of Changes. At noon that day, he had begun to become apprehensive about his appointment with Mr. Chilton, which would occur in 2 more hours. His suite of offices on the 20th floor of the Nippon Times building on Taylor Street overlooked the bay. Through the glass wall, he could watch ships entering, passing beneath the Golden Gate Bridge. At this moment, a freighter could be seen beyond Alcatraz, but Mr. Tagomi did not care. Going to the wall, he unfastened the cord and lowered the bamboo blinds over the view. The large central office became darker. He did not have to squint against the glare. Now he could think more clearly. It was not within his power, he decided, to please his client. No matter what Mr. Chilton came up with, the client would not be impressed. Let us face that, he said to himself. But we can keep him from becoming displeased, at least. We can refrain from insulting him by a moldy gift. The client would soon reach San Francisco Airport by Avenue of the High Place New German Rocket, the Messerschmitt 9E. Mr. Tagomi had never ridden on such a ship. When he met Mr. Baines, he would have to take care to appear blasé, no matter how large the rocket turned out to be. Now to practice. He stood in front of the mirror on the office wall, creating a face of composure, mildly bored, inspecting his own cold features for any giveaway. Yes, they are very noisy, Mr. Baines, sir. One cannot read, but then the flight from Stockholm to San Francisco is only 45 minutes. Perhaps, then, a word about German mechanical failures? I suppose you heard the radio, that crash over Madagascar. I must say there is something to be said for the old piston planes. Essential to avoid politics, for he did not know Mr. Baines's views on leading issues of the day, yet they might arise. Mr. Baines, being Swedish, would be a neutral, yet he had chosen Lufthansa rather than SAS, a cautious ploy. Mr. Baines, sir, they say Herr Bormann is quite ill, that a new Reichschancellor will be chosen by the Partei this autumn. Rumor only? So much secrecy, alas, between Pacific and Reich. In the folder on his desk, clipping from New York Times of a recent speech by Mr. Baines, Mr. Tagomi now studied it critically, bending due to slight failure of correction by his contact lenses. The speech had to do with need of exploring once more, 98th time, for sources of water on the moon. We may still solve this heartbreaking dilemma, Mr. Baines was quoted. Our nearest neighbor, and so far the most unrewarding, except for military purposes. Sick, Mr. Tagomi thought, using high-placed Latin word. Clue to Mr. Baines. Looks askance at merely military. Mr. Tagomi made a mental note. Touching the intercom button, Mr. Tagomi said, Miss Afrikian, I would like you to bring in your tape recorder, please. The outer office door slid to one side, and Miss Afrikian, today pleasantly adorned with blue flowers in her hair, appeared. Bit of lilac, Mr. Tagomi observed. Once he had professionally flower-raised back home on Hokkaido. Miss Afrikian, a tall, brown-haired Armenian girl, bowed.
"Ready with zip-track, Speedmaster?" Mr. Tagomi asked.
"Yes, Mr. Tagomi."
Miss Afrikian seated herself, the portable battery-operated tape recorder ready. Mr. Tagomi began,
"I inquired of the Oracle, will the meeting between myself and Mr. Children be profitable?" And obtained to my dismay the ominous hexagram, the preponderance of the great. The ridgepole is sagging. Too much weight in the middle. All unbalanced. Clearly away from the Tao.
The tape recorder whirred. Pausing, Mr. Tagomi reflected. Miss Afrikian watched him expectantly. The whirring ceased.
"Have Mr. Ramsey come in for a moment, please," Mr. Tagomi said.
"Yes, Mr. Tagomi."
Rising, she put down the tape recorder. Her heels tapped as she departed from the office. With a large folder of bills of lading under his arm, Mr. Ramsey appeared. Young, smiling, he advanced, wearing the natty U.S. Midwest Plains string tie, checkered shirt, and tight beltless blue jeans, considered so high place among the style conscious of the day.
"Howdy, Mr. Tagomi," he said. "Right nice day, sir."
Mr. Tagomi bowed. At that, Mr. Ramsey stiffened abruptly and also bowed.
"I've been consulting the Oracle," Mr. Tagomi said, as Miss Afrikian reseated herself with her tape recorder. "You understand that Mr. Baines, who, as you know, is arriving shortly in person, holds to the Nordic ideology regarding so-called Oriental culture. I could make the effort to dazzle him into a better comprehension with authentic works of Chinese scroll art or ceramics of our Tokugawa period, but it is not our job to convert."
"I see,"
Mr. Ramsey said, his Caucasian face twisted with painful concentration.
"Therefore, we will cater to his prejudice and graft a priceless American artifact to him instead."
"Yes.
You, sir, are of American ancestry, although you have gone to the trouble of darkening your skin color."
He scrutinized Mr. Ramsey.
"A tan achieved by a sun lamp," Mr. Ramsey murmured, "for merely acquiring vitamin D."
But his expression of humiliation gave him away.
"I assure you that I retain authentic roots with—"
Mr. Ramsey stumbled over the words.
"I have not cut off all ties with native ethnic patterns."
Mr. Tagomi said to Miss Afrikian, "Resume, please." Once more the tape recorder whirred.
"In consulting the Oracle and obtaining hexagram Ta Quo 28, I further received the unfavorable line 9 in the fifth place. It reads, a withered poplar puts forth flowers. An older woman takes a husband. No blame, no praise. This clearly indicates that Mr. Children will have nothing of worth to offer us at two."
Mr. Tagomi paused.
"Let us be candid. I cannot rely on my own judgment regarding American art objects. That is why,
he lingered over his choice of terms.
"Why you, Mr. Ramsey, who are, shall I say, native-born, are required. Obviously, we must do the best we can."
Mr. Ramsey had no answer, but despite his efforts to conceal, his features showed hurt, anger, a frustrated and mute reaction.
"Now," Mr. Tagomi said, "I have further consulted the Oracle. For purposes of policy, I cannot divulge to you, Mr. Ramsey, the question."
In other words, his tone meant, "You and your Pinnock kind are not entitled to share the important matters which we deal in."
"It is sufficient to say, however, that I received a most provocative response. It has caused me to ponder at length."
Both Mr. Ramsey and Miss Afrikian watched him intently.
"It deals with Mr. Baines,"
Mr. Tagomi said. They nodded.
"My question regarding Mr. Baines produced through the occult workings of the Tao the hexagram Sheng 46. A good judgment. And line 6 at the beginning, and 9 in the second place."
His question had been, "Will I be able to deal with Mr. Baines successfully?" And the 9 in the second place had assured him that he would. It read, "If one is sincere, it furthers one to bring even a small offering. No blame." Obviously, Mr. Baines would be satisfied by whatever gift the ranking trade mission grafted to him through the good offices of Mr. Tagomi. But Mr. Tagomi, in asking the question, had had a deeper query in the back of his mind, one of which he was barely conscious. As so often, the Oracle had perceived that more fundamental query, and, while answering the other, had taken it upon itself to answer the subliminal one, too.
"As we know," Mr. Tagomi said, "Mr. Baines is bringing us detailed account of new injection molds developed in Sweden. Were we successfully to sign agreement with his firm, we could no doubt replace many present metals, quite scarce, with plastics."
For years, the Pacific had been trying to get basic assistance in the synthetics field from the Reich. However, the big German chemical cartels, IG Farben in particular, had harbored their patents, had, in fact, created a world monopoly in plastics, especially in the development of the polyesters. By this means, Reich trade had kept an edge over Pacific trade, and in technology, the Reich was at least 10 years ahead. The interplanetary rockets leaving Festung Europa consisted mainly of heat-resistant plastics, very light in weight, so hard that they survived even major meteor impact. The Pacific had nothing of this sort. Natural fibers such as wood were still used, and of course the ubiquitous pot metals. Mr. Tagomi cringed as he thought about it. He had seen at trade fairs some of the advanced German work, including an all-synthetic automobile, the DSS, Der Schnell Spuk, which sold in PSA currency for about $600. But his underlying question, one which he could never reveal to the Pinnocks flitting about trade mission offices, had to do with an aspect of Mr. Baines suggested by the original coated cable from Tokyo. First of all, coated material was infrequent and dealt usually with matters of security, not with trade deals. And the cipher was the metaphor type, utilizing poetic allusion, which had been adopted to baffle the Reich monitors, who could crack any literal code, no matter how elaborate. So clearly it was the Reich whom the Tokyo authorities had in mind, not quasi-disloyal cliques in the home islands. The key phrase, skim milk in his diet, referred to Pinafore, to the eerie song that expounded the doctrine, "Things are seldom what they seem. Skim milk masquerades as cream." And the I Ching, when Mr. Tagomi had consulted it, had fortified his insight. Its commentary, "Here a strong man is presupposed. It is true he does not fit in with his environment, inasmuch as he is too brusque and pays too little attention to form. But as he is upright in character, he meets with response." The insight was, simply, that Mr. Baines was not what he seemed, that his actual purpose in coming to San Francisco was not to sign a deal for injection molds, that, in fact, Mr. Baines was a spy. But for the life of him, Mr. Tagomi could not figure out what sort of spy, for whom, or for what. At 1:40 that afternoon, Robert Chilton, with enormous reluctance, locked the front door of American Artistic Handcrafts, Inc. He lugged his heavy cases to the curb, hailed a pedicab, and told the Chink to take him to the Nippon Times building. The Chink, gaunt-faced, hunched over and perspiring, gasped a place-conscious acknowledgment and began loading Mr. Chilton's bags aboard. Then, having assisted Mr. Chilton himself into the carpet-lined seat, the Chink clicked on the meter, mounted his own seat, and pedaled off along Montgomery Street, among the cars and buses. The entire day had been spent finding the item for Mr. Tagomi, and Chilton's bitterness and anxiety almost overwhelmed him as he watched the buildings pass. And yet, triumph. The separate skill, apart from the rest of him, he had found the right thing, and Mr. Tagomi would be mollified, and his client, whoever he was, would be overjoyed. "I always give satisfaction," Chilton thought, "to my customers." He had been able to procure, miraculously, an almost mint copy of Volume 1, Number 1 of Tip Top Comics. Dating from the 30s, it was a choice piece of Americana, one of the first funny books, a prize collectors searched for constantly. Of course, he had other items with him to show first. He would lead up gradually to the funny book, which lay well protected in a leather case packed in tissue paper at the center of the largest bag. The radio of the pedicab blared out popular tunes, competing with the radios of other cabs, cars, and buses. Chilton did not hear. He was used to it. Nor did he take notice of the enormous neon signs, with their permanent ads obliterating the front of virtually every large building. After all, he had his own sign. At night, it blazed on and off in company with all the others of the city. What other way did one advertise? One had to be realistic. In fact, the uproar of radios, traffic noises, the signs and people lulled him. They blotted out his inner worries. And it was pleasurable to be peddled along by another human being, to feel the straining muscles of the Chink transmitted in the form of regular vibrations, a sort of relaxing machine, Chilton reflected, to be pulled instead of having to pull, and to have, if even for a moment, higher place. Guiltily, he woke himself. Too much to plan, no time for a midday doze. Was he absolutely properly dressed to enter the Nippon Times building? Possibly he would faint in the high-speed elevator. But he had motion illness tablets with him, a German compound. The various modes of address, he knew them. Whom to treat politely, whom rudely. Be brusque with the doorman, elevator operator, receptionist, guide, any janitorial person. Bow to any Japanese, of course, even if it obliged him to bow hundreds of times. But the pinocs? Nebulous area. Bow, but look straight through them, as if they did not exist. Did that cover every situation, then? What about a visiting foreigner? Germans often could be seen at the trade missions, as well as neutrals. And then, too, he might see a slave. German or South ships docked at the port of San Francisco all the time, and blacks occasionally were allowed off for short intervals, always in groups of fewer than three, and they could not be out after nightfall. Even under Pacific law, they had to obey the curfew. But also slaves unloaded at the docks, and these lived perpetually ashore, in shacks under the wharves, above the waterline. None would be in the trade mission offices, but if any unloading were taking place, for instance, should he carry his own bags to Mr. Tagomi's office? Surely not. A slave would have to be found, even if he had to stand waiting an hour, even if he missed his appointment. It was out of the question to let a slave see him carrying something. He had to be quite careful of that. A mistake of that kind would cost him dearly. He would never have place of any sort again among those who saw. In a way, Chilton thought, I would almost enjoy carrying my own bags into the Nippon Times building in broad daylight. What a grand gesture. It is not actually illegal. I would not go to jail. And I would show my real feelings, the side of a man which never comes out in public life. But I could do it, he thought. If there weren't those damn black slaves lurking around, I could endure those above me seeing it, their scorn. After all, they scorn me and humiliate me every day. But to have those beneath see me, to feel their contempt, like this chink pedaling away ahead of me, if I hadn't taken a pedicab, if he had seen me trying to walk to a business appointment. One had to blame the Germans for the situation. Tendency to bite off more than they could chew. After all, they had barely managed to win the war, and at once they had gone off to conquer the solar system, while at home they had passed edicts which, well, at least the idea was good. And, after all, they had been successful with the Jews and Gypsies and Bible students. And the Slavs had been rolled back 2,000 years' worth to their heartland in Asia. Out of Europe entirely, to everyone's relief. Back to riding yaks and hunting with bow and arrow. And those great glossy magazines printed in Munich and circulated around to all the libraries and newsstands. One could see the full-page color pictures for oneself. The blue-eyed, blonde-haired Aryan settlers who now industriously tilled, culled, plowed, and so forth in the vast grain bowl of the world, the Ukraine. Those fellows certainly looked happy, and their farms and cottages were clean. You didn't see pictures of drunken, dull-witted Poles anymore, slouched on sagging porches or hawking a few sickly turnips at the village market. All a thing of the past, like rutted dirt roads that once turned to slop in the rainy season, bogging down the carts. But Africa, they had simply let their enthusiasm get the better of them there, and you had to admire that, although more thoughtful advice would have cautioned them to perhaps let it wait a bit until, for instance, Project Farmland had been completed. Now there the Nazis had shown genius. The artist in them had truly emerged. The Mediterranean Sea, bottled up, drained, made into tillable farmland through the use of atomic power, what daring! How the sniggerers had been set back on their heels, for instance, certain scoffing merchants along Montgomery Street. And as a matter of fact, Africa had almost been successful. But in a project of that sort, almost was an ominous word to begin to hear. Rosenberg's well-known powerful pamphlet issued in 1958, the word had first shown up then. As to the final solution of the African problem, we have almost achieved our objectives. Unfortunately, however, still, it had taken 200 years to dispose of the American Aborigines, and Germany had almost done it in Africa in 15 years. So no criticism was legitimately in order. Chilton had, in fact, argued it out recently while having lunch with certain of those other merchants. They expected miracles, evidently, as if the Nazis could remold the world by magic. No, it was science and technology and that fabulous talent for hard work. The Germans never stopped applying themselves. And when they did a task, they did it right. And anyhow, the flights to Mars had distracted world attention from the difficulty in Africa. So it all came back to what he had told his fellow store owners. What the Nazis have which we lack is nobility. Admire them for their love of work or their efficiency, but it's the dream that stirs one. Space flights first to the moon, then to Mars. If that isn't the oldest yearning of mankind, our finest hope for glory. Now the Japanese, on the other hand, I know them pretty well. I do business with them, after all, day in and day out. They are, let's face it, Orientals, yellow people. We whites have to bow to them because they hold the power, but we watch Germany. We see what can be done where whites have conquered, and it's quite different.
We approach the Nippon Times building, sir,
the Chink said, his chest heaving from the exertion of the hill climbing. He slowed now. To himself, Children tried to picture Mr. Tagomi's client. Clearly, the man was unusually important. Mr. Tagomi's tone on the telephone, his immense agitation, had communicated the fact. Image of one of Children's own very important clients, or rather customers, swam up into his mind. A man who had done a good deal to create for Children a reputation among the high-placed personages residing in the Bay Area. 4 years ago, Children had not been the dealer in the rare and desirable which he was now. He had operated a small, rather dimly lighted second-hand bookshop on Geary. His neighboring stores sold used furniture or hardware or did laundry. It was not a nice neighborhood. At night, strong-arm robberies and sometimes rape took place on the sidewalk, despite the efforts of the San Francisco Police Department and even the Kempai Tai, the Japanese higher-ups. All store windows had iron gratings fitted over them once the business day had ended, this to prevent forcible entry. Yet into this district of the city had come an elderly Japanese ex-army man, a Major Ito Humo. Tall, slender, white-haired, walking and standing stiffly, Major Humo had given Children his first inkling of what might be done with his line of merchandise.
I am a collector, Major Humo had explained.
He spent an entire afternoon searching among the heaps of old magazines in the store. In his mild voice, he had explained something which Children could not quite grasp at the time. To many wealthy, cultured Japanese, the historic objects of American popular civilization were of equal interest alongside the more formal antiques. Why this was so, the Major himself did not know. He was particularly addicted to the collecting of old magazines dealing with U.S. brass buttons, as well as the buttons themselves. It was on the order of coin or stamp collecting. No rational explanation could ever be given. And high prices were being paid by wealthy collectors.
I will give you an example, the Major had said. Do you know what is meant by horrors of war cards?
He had eyed Children with avidity. Searching his memory, Children had at last recalled. The cards had been dispensed during his childhood with bubble gum, a cent apiece. There had been a series of them, each card depicting a different horror.
A dear friend of mine, the Major had gone on, collects horrors of war. He lacks but one now, the sinking of the Panay. He has offered a substantial sum of money for that particular card.
Flip cards, Children had said suddenly.
Sir?
We flipped them. There was a head and a tail side on each card. He had been about 8 years old. Each of us had a pack of flip cards. We stood, two of us, facing each other. Each of us dropped a card so that it flipped in the air. The boy whose card landed with the head side up, the side with the picture, won both cards.
How enjoyable to recall those good days, those early happy days of his childhood. Considering, Major Humo had said,
I have heard my friend discuss his horrors of war cards, but he has never mentioned this. It is my opinion that he does not know how these cards actually were put to use.
Eventually, the Major's friend had shown up at the store to hear Children's historically first-hand account. That man, also a retired officer of the Imperial Army, had been fascinated.
Bottle caps!
Children had exclaimed without warning. The Japanese had blinked uncomprehendingly.
We used to collect the tops from milk bottles, as kids, the round tops that gave the name of the dairy. There must have been thousands of dairies in the United States. Each one printed a special top.
The officer's eyes had glinted with the instinct.
Do you possess any of your sometime collections, sir?
Naturally, Children did not. But probably it was still possible to obtain the ancient, long-forgotten tops from the days before the war, when milk had come in glass bottles rather than throwaway pasteboard cartons. And so, by stages, he had gotten into the business. Others had opened similar places, taking advantage of the ever-growing Japanese craze for Americana, but Shildon had always kept his edge.
"Your fare," the Chink was saying, bringing him out of his meditation. "It's a dollar, sir."
He had unloaded the bags and was waiting. Absent-mindedly, Chilton paid him. Yes, it was quite likely that the client of Mr. Tagomi resembled Major Humo. At least, Chilton thought tartly, from my point of view. He had dealt with so many Japanese, but he still had difficulty telling them apart. There were the short, squat ones, built like wrestlers, then the druggist-like ones, the tree-shrub-flower-gardener ones. He had his categories. And the young ones, who were to him not like Japanese at all. Mr. Tagomi's client would probably be portly, a businessman, smoking a Philippine cigar. And then, standing before the Nippon Times building, with his bags on the sidewalk beside him, Chilton suddenly thought with a chill, suppose his client isn't Japanese? Everything in the bags had been selected with them in mind, their tastes. But the man had to be Japanese. A Civil War recruiting poster had been Mr. Tagomi's original order. Surely only a Japanese would care about such debris. Typical of their mania for the trivial, their legalistic fascination with documents, proclamations, ads. He remembered one who had devoted his leisure time to collecting newspaper ads of American patent medicines of the 1900s. There were other problems to face, immediate problems. Through the high doors of the Nippon Times building, men and women hurried, all of them well-dressed, their voices reaching Chilton's ears, and he started into motion. A glance upward at the towering edifice, the highest building in San Francisco, wall of offices, windows, the fabulous design of the Japanese architects, and the surrounding gardens of dwarf evergreens, rocks, the Karasansui landscape, sand imitating a dried-up stream winding past roots among simple, irregular flat stones. He saw a black who had carried baggage, now free. At once, Chilton called,
"Porter!"
The black trotted toward him, smiling.
"To the 20th floor," Chilton said in his harshest voice. "Suite B, at once."
He indicated the bags and then strode on toward the doors of the building. Naturally, he did not look back. A moment later, he found himself being crowded into one of the express elevators, mostly Japanese around him, their clean faces shining slightly in the brilliant light of the elevator. Then the nauseating upward thrust of the elevator, the rapid click of floors passing. He shut his eyes, planted his feet firmly, prayed for the flight to end. The black, of course, had taken the bags up on a service elevator. It would not have been within the realm of reason to permit him here. In fact, Chilton opened his eyes and looked momentarily. He was one of the few whites in the elevator. When the elevator let him off on the 20th floor, Chilton was already bowing mentally, preparing himself for the encounter in Mr. Tagomi's offices.